This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
You haven't heard about the McCrispy yet? Well then, you probably haven't heard the sweet silence after the first crispy bite either. Go try it for yourself to hear the best not sound you've ever heard.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network. My name is Anna Lindner, and I am a new host on the network. And today, we're very lucky to be able to talk to the author of this book, Black or Right, Anti/Racist Campus Rhetorics, Louis M. Mirage. He is a native of Trinidad and Tobago, and he thinks, creates, and converses with and through theoretical Black studies, rhetoric, digital media, and critical pedagogies. His scholarship specifically addresses anti/racism, anti/blackness, an expressive form. His book, which explores everyday notions of blackness in historically white institutions, is the winner of the SEES 2022 Outstanding Book Award. His recent essays appear in Prose Studies, Women's Communication Studies and Communication, and Films for the Feminist Classroom. He is an assistant professor in the University of British Columbia's School of Journalism, Writing, and Media. Louis, thanks so much for coming on.
Of course, and thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it.
Yeah, so as we talk about your book, I briefly introduced you, but do you have anything that you want to talk about in terms of where you grew up or the inspiration for writing this book, your education, etc.?
Yeah, sure. So I'm from the Caribbean island of Trinidad. That's where I was born and raised. And growing up, I kind of idolized academics, almost historians, folks like C.L.R. James and Eric Williams, who were, I think, both, you know, academics and historians and writers and authors, but also very politically involved with decolonization of the Caribbean and Trinidad in particular. And so I always looked up to those people, and I sort of decided fairly early on that I wanted to be a doctor, but then realized I couldn't really actually engage the site of blood. So it wasn't going to happen, that it wasn't going to be a medical doctor. And so I left Trinidad to go to school in the States originally to become a journalist. And so I went to a small public liberal arts college called Ramapo College in New Jersey in my undergrad there. While there, I had the privilege of going on a study abroad trip to India for six months, which was very, it was generative in the sense that this was where I started having an interest in social justice. The study abroad trip was focused on peace and justice movements, women's rights movements, labor movements, environmental movements there. And so I got interested in that sort of stuff, but then went to graduate school, Texas Tech, to become a poet. I was very interested in poetry, so I did a master's degree out in Lubbock, Texas. while there, I had an especially violent encounter with the police. And that started to sort of change the trajectory in terms of how I thought about my presence in the United States as someone who identifies as a Black, at the time, a Black international student. After that, Black immigrant / migrant worker. Before, you know, I'm now in Canada. So, went to graduate school there to do a master's degree. Then I went to Ohio State, where I did my PhD after deciding that I wanted to switch my focus to study literature. I started off there studying very old literature, early modern literature, Renaissance literature, because I was really interested in poetic form and how people use language in particular ways, particularly at the beginning of what is understood to be, you know, quote unquote, modernity, or what we understand as, like, you know, the sort of modern world. Didn't really feel like I fit in studying that. So during that time, it was about 2014, 2015, the Ferguson uprising happened. The Black Lives Matter movement started to generate a lot of attention and to change a lot of people's minds and a lot of the ways that we think about Blackness. And for me, having been in the U.S., I as somebody from the Caribbean, I always felt alienated, most of the time felt alienated in spaces that were quote unquote Black spaces, because of my identity as someone who is not from the U.S. But the Black Lives Matter movement, in sort of unpacking what it meant, kind of really focused in on different kinds of Blackness. It was a movement that was not necessarily interested in particularly like the U.S. context, and I saw myself sort of really getting interested in what the Black Lives Matter movement meant, and that turned the direction of like what I wanted to study, because I was really then confronted a lot in classrooms as I was starting to teach with my own my idea of Blackness was being challenged by doing the job of teaching at historically white institutions. So this is something I actually recount in the first chapter of the book. An encounter where a student kept asking, a Black male student, American student, kept asking, "Are you Black?" And this was really, I think, the point at which the book started. It was thinking about why, if I was saying yes, I do identify as Black, why that would be challenged. Vociferously, so, you know, repeatedly. And that got me thinking about in what ways do Black people communicate, you know, their Blackness, in what ways, in what expressive forms, in what rhetorics what rhetorics do Black people use to communicate their presence in historically white spaces, and particularly violent historically white spaces? And so that is a very quick overview of, you know, what led me to the book. The book was first my dissertation, and started to think about it a little bit differently following the dissertation, revised it, and it became Black All Right, anti/racist campus rhetorics.
Great. Yeah, and speaking about those slashes, let's talk briefly about those stylistic choices. So for those who are not as familiar with the more critical scholarship and the use of those slashes, parentheses, etc., could you explain what that usage suggests about the fixity and/or power of language, and why that is so central to your work?
For sure. So Black All Right is interested in thinking about, as I mentioned before, how folks, and that's student, staff, faculty, and people in surrounding communities at historically white institutions make meaning. One of the central ideas in the book is that Blackness is not something that is fixed or can't be fixed to one particular meaning. It's not a monolith. It's not something that can be described in a very finite way. And despite attempts to do that. And so the way that the book is using, or the way I am using language in the book, and using these slashes and using parentheses, in some cases I'm using poems to communicate, the way that these slashes and the way that language is used in the book is to really communicate that Blackness is a moving thing, and that even language structures can be restrictive, oppressive, in terms of thinking about what things might mean. And so there are a lot of ways that the slashes in the book, so the slashes are there to mean and or, but they're also about the possibilities, you know, of beside, and under, and over, and thinking about what the different sides, the words on the different sides of a slash means. If you go through the book and you read a particular sentence without one of those terms, it'll give you one meaning. If you read it with the other, it'll give you another. If you read it with a slash, it'll give you another. And so there are particular places where this is really stressed to evoke particular kinds of imagery. One of my favorite sort of uses of slashes in the book is relation/ships in breaking up the weird relationships, because it both calls and harkens to the transatlantic slave trade and the role of ships in that history, which is brought up in the book a few times, and about relationality and the relations between people and the relationship between histories, etc. So there are ways that the slashes are working to perform what the book is arguing. And in some ways, the uses of language, as you might have noticed, it's not all standardized American English. It embraces language or Englishes from the Caribbean that are really not, there are no standardized ways to spell some of these words, and that's something I'm also playing with. So there might be instances where I'm using a particular expression in Trini English, and then I'm using the same expression and it's not spelled the same way. So I want to break out of this idea that there is one way to think about Blackness, and that's the role that the language in the book is playing.
That's great. Very important for questioning the ways that we are using language and thinking about language, approaching language, and assuming about language. And to kind of complement that work that you're doing with the type of grammatical, you know, signifying, if you will, you talk about the theoretical frameworks that you're using, which involve Black feminists and African indigenous methodologies as well that guide your analysis. Could you talk a little bit more about both of those, which are obviously, again, not monolithic, so it might be hard to summarize, and explain why that grounding is so important for considering what's at stake, not just for your work kind of more narrowly, but in terms of the many manifestations of Black being, and especially when we consider that this is in the face of very violent anti-Blackness.
For sure. So I'll start by sort of talking a little bit about the African indigenous sort of research methodologies that are the book is grounded in. So I am sort of engaging with theories about both human being and sort of doing work or exchanging knowledge in particular communities that are based on a concept called Botho or Ubuntu, which sort of it tries to think with the ways in what we're in the work that we do in our lives, and particularly in as a research methodology, to think about all our particular relations to specifically the most marginalized beings, whether sort of living or dead, and to have respect for those beings and the way and to understand there's a particular relationship always between how we treat each other, how we treat our environments, and there's a respect for thinking about space and thinking about other people that particular concept affords. And so the book is grounded in that, and particularly mobilizes that in thinking through what I call, or what I, not me, but what is termed as Black feminist relationality. And that concept is really about thinking through the way that systemic power, interpersonal power, and communicative power all are wrapped up in, as Patricia Hill Collins, Black feminist thinker, calls matrices of domination, the way that our identities and our positionalities are shaped by multiple facets of our being, and really thinking about all of those in generative ways, in terms of, you know, in a lot of ways, the book is about the way people communicate, but it's also about how power is constantly involved in that. It's not simply at an interpersonal level, which is one way people tend to read racism and anti-racism. You know, if you see someone and stereotype them, that's one way that's, you know, the primary way that racism works. But relationality affords us to understand, like, what are the systems of power that are operating to make those stereotypes happen? So, you know, thinking about the well of tropes that's being drawn on when someone sees someone and stereotypes them, and how that is implicated by each party's sort of positionality and relationship to those systems of power, who has access because of whiteness, who has access because of economic class, who has access because of ability and able-bodiedness, who has access because of how what, you know, language it is that they speak primarily, et cetera, et cetera. The taking those approaches allowed me to think really carefully and deeply about how communication is fraught in relationship to all of these systems of power that we might not see every day, right? But is overwhelmingly a part of the way that anti-Blackness functions, and, you know, capitalism functions and neoliberalism functions, etc.
Yeah, I think your work does a really good job at drawing all of those together in a way that remains coherent, which, you know, as you know, is very difficult to do. And is able to kind of zoom in and zoom out as historians, for example, we're always struggling with the general and the particular, the specific and the broad. And I feel like your work moves through those really well in a way that's you're able to follow, which is, again, difficult to do. And speaking of the particular, you mentioned this at the beginning, but in the first chapter, you talk about interactions with one of the Black students in your class, T, and you talk about how that relates to negotiations of Blacknesses, if you will, with / in the academy. Expanding on what you already mentioned, maybe talk a little bit about how that connects to Sharpe's call to become undisciplined and why that's important for people like yourself who have decided to try to negotiate Blackness both within but then also beyond and outside of the academy with a justice kind of critical orientation.
Yeah, thanks for that question. It's a very good question. So the interaction between me and this particular student, most instructors, most teachers, most professors might see that kind of interaction as a kind of disruption, and maybe would try to stop it from happening. And I'm not going to say that when it was happening, it wasn't incredibly uncomfortable. But one of the things that the book is interested in theorizing and thinking about is generative disruption. What does it mean for disruption to do more than simply shake up or temporarily call the status quo into question? And so what I think T was doing, or what I read T as doing through this constant questioning and the way that the questions were being asked. So it was first asked, are you Black? And then I said, yeah, and explained my particular background. And that had me questioning a lot of things in terms of, is it my accent that mocks me as someone who's not from America? Is it the way that I dress? Is it my gender performance? Is it my skin tone? Is it like, are we talking in terms as somebody who is light skinned? This particular student was dark skinned, and so it was it sort of something about racism at the intersection of colorism that we were talking about, like the reasoning behind what we were the tension. And then it was asked in relation specifically to the history of the transatlantic slave plantation and the transatlantic slave trade, where this particular student asked, if this was, slave days, would you be the house slave and would I be in the field? And again, I sort of started to think through, like, what does this mean? Is it because I'm an instructor in front of a classroom? Is it because of the space we were in? Is it, is it because of the material that we were engaging? And then one of the final times that the final time it was asked the question, it was specifically in relation to the N-word. And if I use it and how I engage that, and then sort of that had me thinking about language and what who owns language and who can claim to be a particular identity because they can use particular kinds of language. And so I simply asked T at that point, what is it about me that is not, that's not convincing, or, why do you keep asking this question? He responded by saying it was because I was in front of the classroom. I was a teacher in this particular space. And I'm fairly sure that it was all of those things, not simply that it, the environment, but the particular environment and my positionality in it, that gave me a way to think about bodies and spaces and what is all caught up in the way that we communicate and then the way that we relate to each other. What are the histories that are there? How is, how are things like nationality and gender color, et cetera, caught up in what we believe to be a particular identity? The way that this connects with Christina Sharpe's work, connects with Christina Sharpe's work in a lot of ways, but the way that it connects to this notion of being undisciplined is that had I in terms of the level of sort of literal sort of like classroom discipline or etiquette. Had I not been open to seeing that as sort of a generative fracture or a reason for conversation, we could have, I could have mobilized my authority as an instructor and stopped that conversation from happening throughout throughout the semester. But it was in embracing this sort of, okay, this is a question. It's not the most comfortable question, but it is a really sort of generative, question to sort of sit with. Then we can sort of take out this, we can play with the idea that Blackness is, or can be represented as one thing, right? It's not one particular word. It's not one particular color. It's not one particular kind of gender performance. And in this case, specifically, Black masculinity isn't, you know, one particular gender performance. And so there was a lot to be thought about and said about allowing space for that disruption. And it was, there was, in terms of, and I understand this notion of becoming undisciplined, as operating in a number of ways. So one way that the book overall is doing it is thinking through, not being bound to any particular kind of, field of thought, one particular academic discipline, you know, drawing from a lot of different authors from a bunch of different fields to make and think through its arguments. But also, as we talked before, undisciplining the very sort of mechanics of language, using slashes, using parentheses, using language that when I was brought up, I was told was broken English, right? That was wrong, right? To think through, why do we have these notions of right and wrong, which goes to the title of the book. And so the idea of undisciplining, when I'm telling the story, it ends on this kind of spoken word, which is not really a spoken word because it's printed. But it, you know, it's something that I've performed before, addressed to T, because that was the way that I think, would, effectively communicate our relationship and our relationality, to each other, on this question of what is Blackness. And so there are that undisciplining is working in a number of ways. It's sort of working at the level of sort of interpersonal communication, sort of being okay with the discomfort of a disruption or a disruption to authority, in the case of student instructor relationship, and being sort of okay with this. Idea that we don't necessarily always have to talk to one audience or one group of thinkers when we think about Blackness, because in that way we kind of cordon off, Blackness means on a sociological level, what Blackness means on a rhetorical level, what Blackness means on, you know, in terms of gender and sexuality, in ways that are that kind of pigeonhole how we think about Blackness and anti-Blackness. It's also working on the level of undisciplining how we think about different categories of identity. That, you know, racial identity cannot be thought of without thinking about gender identity, without thinking about one's sort of ability or disabilities, without thinking about one's class and economic wealth, without thinking about, you know, all of these things that make up our intersectional identities. And so to undisciplined meaning is to really to call into question really that way of reading where we think, okay, we're talking right now about Blackness, right? So we're talking about race. But no, we're actually talking about gender, and we're talking about space, and we're talking about education, and we're also talking about sociology, but we're also talking about sexuality in some ways, and we're talking about class and language use and so on. So this is something that's cutting across the entire book. At the beginning, there's an invitation to think in this way about the contents that are about to come, you know, thinking it along the mode of something we say in Trinidad, mashing up the place, which is to destroy any concept of, I mean, there's two ways it can be read. It's, you know, it can be read as a really joyful thing, celebration, and another way as like being disruptive. And I want to, and there's a way that that phrase embodies that kind of mix and play and relational sort of nature of Blackness. And so I invite readers to not think along the lines of, okay, well, I've understood this now, or I don't understand this now after I read it, but to think more dynamically about knowledge and the way that sometimes not knowing what something means is actually a way of knowing. And so that all has to do with this idea of being undisciplined and not simply thinking about things in terms of wrong and right, or good and bad, or black or white, right? So, that's a great question. Thank you for asking that.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
You haven't heard about the McCrispy yet. Well then, you probably haven't heard the sweet silence after the first crispy bite either. Go try it for yourself to hear the best not sound you've ever heard.
Yeah, and that's a good explanation. It's this kind of unbounded nexus of so many things that is at the heart of critical studies and theory that is really hard to capture in language, which is obviously the central problem and central kind of thrust of this study in general. And to kind of get at capturing or not capturing, or, you know, trying to but not being able to, these kind of tangled intersections, you use a metaphor that I think kind of helps with that a little bit. Might be a metaphor, it might be a method, it might be a theoretical lens. Deep rhetorical ecologies to theorize the para/ontology, which, you know, goes to what you were just talking about. Well, it's more epistemologies, knowing, not knowing, not knowing as a form of knowing, of Black being, and wake work, again, to talk about Shark, who you pull in a lot, and who I think obviously is very helpful for understanding what's happening here. Why is interconnectedness so important to those ontologies, as well as to the decisions you made about text to analyze, as well as, you know, more in terms of your pedagogy, the curricula you teach, for example?
So interconnectedness, again, I think is related to the sort of methodological frameworks, to Black feminist relationality, to the African indigenous framework that I use as a basis for doing this study. Is related to those particular concepts that you touch on in a lot of ways. So I guess I think maybe explaining a little bit about what each of those concepts mean and how they're related to the content might be a way to approach this. So in terms of the deep rhetorical ecology, what I'm thinking about is not simply how people or objects or spaces communicate information, but also the interconnected intercontextual ways that histories and other bodies not present within that particular space. So when going back to the example of tea, when we were in the classroom space, our conversation was at one point, about transatlantic slavery. Why? Because that was an important sort of historical framework for tea to understand our power dynamics. There's a way that scholarship that has used this metaphor, the rhetorical ecology, has used it to think about humans and their relationships to the environment, in relationship to objects, and the way that objects make meaning. But I'm sort of pushing a little against that to think about the ways that power is implicated in all of that. To think about, for instance, how communities surrounding a particular college campus are implicated in what's happening on that campus and vice versa. And so in the fourth chapter of the book, I talk about, living in this off-campus neighborhood and seeing this sort of anti-Nazi poster and how that, what that means in that particular moment, because on the same street, I had been jumped by someone I would term a vigilante who thought I had mugged him earlier in the night. And so there's a lot of ways that campus policing is related to that space that you don't necessarily see if we say we're just going to read this classroom as a site. And so I wanted to make sure that in my use of the rhetorical ecology, I was thinking deeply about power relations, history, and the way the immediate situation, reading the immediate situation, isn't always going to give us the necessary tools for understanding communication in a particular moment, or not understanding communication in a particular moment. So that's the deep rhetorical ecology. Para/ontology, when I'm thinking about that, I'm thinking with a couple strains of philosophical thought in Black studies. On one side, folks who study ontology, the nature of being and what it means for Black people. And are Black people even able to have or to claim being in a white world where the sort of racist understandings of Blackness is that, it was something it is something that is mapped on to Black people for the purpose of domination and violence, for the purpose of white supremacy. And so I'm thinking with scholars who have theorized about ontology, Frantz Fanon in particular, but how that has led to thought on the way that Black people don't have ontological resistance or can't claim to be in particular ways in white spaces and the white world. So there are groups of scholars, particular camps that understand this question in different ways. So for instance, Afro-pessimists understand that Blackness, or some Afro-pessimists, I should say, understand that Blackness is an ontological zero. Calvin Warren, for instance, that there is no sort of Black being within the white world. And so that's on one side of the slash. That's ontology, Black ontology. On the other side is para-ontology. This means of escaping the fugitive spaces to create different sort of imaginative contacts and wills for being otherwise, being free, or quote unquote free, to express Blackness in particular ways. And there are folks like Fred Moten and Naam Chandler who have theorized paraontology as this sort of fugitive will that one might find through particular means in particular spaces, through particular cultural performances. The slash is important here because what I want to do is get at what's in between that. How do Black people both engage fugitivity in educational spaces and also experience being being nothing, right? Or being thought of as nothing. And so I'm using the slash here to find the spaces or the moments, however ephemeral, in between that registers on the level of here's a way that the white academy or the white academic space is telling you you're nothing, or you're, you know, or it is dehumanizing you, or making you disposable. Here is a way in response to that, that students, activists, you know, faculty, staff are finding ways to turn it back onto that white frame to say, well, actually, in this moment, what you're doing is, you know, blank, to call out that, you know, that kind of anti-Black racism, while also, you know, still being kind of trapped in this, you know, space of disposability. And so there's a kind of it's kind of oxymoronic. It's sort of like, you know, you can do so much to find that those fugitive spaces, but because of the way that anti-Blackness works is that it can come creeping in. And so the slash is really important for the reader to think through, okay, you know, how do I see this, right? As a reader, am I seeing or understanding this as a way to be free within this particular white space? Or am I seeing this as another way to be captured and used as a particular object for white purposes? And the particular rhetorics that the book offers, the four rhetorics of Black odd ethnography, Black hashtagging, Black intercontextual reading, and generative Black disruption, all speak to, are all sort of modalities of para/ontological Blackness. So that we understand if when we tell our stories public research in an autoethnographic framework, that we're both resisting by telling our stories and approaching a particular subject in our own sort of, from our own positionalities in a different way. But that, you know, is caught up in the stereotype that Black people are not thinkers, they're, you know, performers, right? and autoethnography is caught in that bind while in some ways resisting it. And in the same way, a hashtag on social media might point to a particular idea for the purposes of social justice, it can also be co-opted, right? Hashtag Black Lives Matter, the life story of it is, you know, now related to hashtag All Lives Matter because it was co-opted. And co-opted in other ways too, by fake profiles on social media, sending false information, etc. But the hashtag as a unit is a way to understand Black communication as both resistant or being resisting hegemonic power, and also caught up in, you know, the same kinds of racist capitalist, you know, ways that Blackness is often used as a commodity. So, you know, hashtags inherently are used to sell people things. Hashtags are used to surveil. And so Those are just two examples, but those are examples of the ways that para/ontology is working through these particular kinds of communicative means. And so these concepts all come through in these concepts. By that I mean deep rhetorical ecologies and para/ontological blackness come through when we start thinking about things at the granular level, at the level of let's look at this particular hashtag and let's look at how it's working, which is what chapter two is doing. Let's look at these particular stories and then think really, you know, think both with the content of the stories, but also the form of the stories, what it's doing for blackness, what it's doing for and to anti-blackness. Those concepts, you can see it through the particular rhetorics that the book argues for as important to think about within white educational spaces as ways to resist, but also ways that one might still be caught up in a racist structure. Which again speaks back to the slash anti/ racist campus rhetorics. There's a way that there's so much talk around anti-racism because of racism, right? Anti-racism only exists because racism exists, and the interplay between that is something that I find fascinating to think about.
Yeah. Well, and talking about those types of, you know, resistance and or lack thereof or attempts or resisting but still being implicated in white supremacist structures, you talk about a clash that was recorded between mostly black and some brown students who were protesting by occupying a university building. And then they were clashing with the university, you know, administrators. You note that in the context of blackness at the university, and I quote, difference, instead of signaling diversity, in scare quotes, spotlights deviance. And this made me think about, and you mentioned this at one point, kind of the neoliberal ideal of colorblindness, race blindness, and then the way that diversity is this buzzword that actually obscures what's happening in actuality on the ground in terms of anti-blackness, but then also resistance to that. How do you think that kind of clash operates in the context of race blindness, but then also kind of the hyper visibility of blackness as deviance?
Yeah, another great question, and I think that clash is something that the book is actively sort of exploring and trying to think about how that sort of bubbles up and is communicated in particular tense moments. And so I'm building on the work of cultural theorist Sarah Ahmed, who's On Being Included, whose book On Being Included theorizes that diversity initiatives and even the word at diversity at historically white institutions is works as a quote unquote non-performative, meaning that it supposedly achieves what it's supposed to achieve just by the bare fact of it being a thing, a policy, but in fact doesn't do anything. And so I wanted with this book to think specifically about how that relates to Black people, and they're being sort of seen as representations of diversity. And so I'm thinking about this throughout the book, really. You pointed to a spot in chapter 4 in terms of the protest. But in chapter 1, I'm thinking about this along sort of my own identity and how I was, you know, my image has been used for these purposes. But, you know, also in terms of how staff and how other, you know, faculty, students, etc., are being read along these particular lines. So the chapter that you point out is specifically about policy at white educational institutions, and attempts to read a series of artifacts related to quote unquote diversity, but also in relation to security. In a particular six month period. So when the book looks at what, you know, security mechanisms are in place in the 6 month period in 2016, I look at notifications about campus crime. Though there are, you know, thousands of crimes, particular notifications come to students, staff, and faculty about you know, the most dangerous crimes. And within that period, I believe all of them involve the word Black, and descriptions of what are stereotypes of Black people, wearing certain hairstyles, wearing certain kinds of clothes, etc. And a lot, at the same time, there are student activists who are attempting to get the university to stop sort of giving money to really corrupt, awful, you know, companies, and to really just be transparent, honestly, about its operations. I think the movement that I write about, the particular protest, was really about, hey, just tell us what, you know, how much you have invested. Tell us how much, you know, where the money you're gaining from tuition and from endowments, etc., is, you know, where that is going to. And the students are simply having a sit-in, I don't want to necessarily get into, you know, quote unquote violent and nonviolent protests and that, you know, but this is a nonviolent protest. They're sitting, right? Because violence depends on the reader of, you know, of the situation. And so these students are being asked to leave by white administration for a number of issues, and they're using particular words to describe these students, these white administrators, disruptive, all of these sort of code words, right, for saying effectively that they're racialized in a particular way. And so that's where this whole idea of how the clash between the university mobilizing diversity for its purposes while also mobilizing racially colorblind language comes to a head. So you see this administrator using language to describe these students who are simply sitting in particular ways, but not saying, hey, you know, obviously I'm saying this because you're Black and you're brown students. And as these protesters are asking for clarification, what did we do? Why are we disruptive? They're saying, what, you rushed the door when your food came. They're saying, but we didn't. The cops stopped the food from coming in. So that's where the perceived rush came from. It was the emergency to get it beyond the barrier. And the administrators are sort of doubling down on that's disruption. You're disrupting the sort of usual flow of business in this building at 10 p.m. or sometime late at night. That the workers who would come to do their jobs the next day are not going to be comfortable coming into this building. if they're there at 10 the night before. And so at one point, one of these protesters, a Black woman, very clearly says, you know, these protesters are asking, why are we disruptive? They're saying, they're threatening really violence, you know, to throw you into paddy wagons, I believe is a phrase that was used, which has its own sort of historical connotations, right? Because, you know, who talks about police violence in this way in 2016? You know, it shows a particular kind of thought pattern. But the students then respond, you're calling us these things because we're people of color. And it's in that moment, I think we can understand something like para/ontology, where to say that, to make that call out, is to call attention to the racial stress of the moment, of the white university attempting to unrace the situation and say, well, you're good students, but you're being disruptive. And to understand that as, no, we're simply being students of color in this space, and you're asking, you're saying that we're being violent and disruptive when we're simply here. And so this connects with the larger, you know, campus ecology when you think about these text messages and these notifications that are going out and saying, you know, look out for a Black man between 5'7" and 5'10" who is wearing jeans and a white t-shirt. That creates this air of what, again, Christina Schaap would call brutal imagination, where it's easy to map disruptive, it's easy to map criminal onto Black bodies in this space. And what that chapter is attempting to do is to show how these everyday things, you know, student protests happens all the time. The notification, crime notifications, I believe are still happening on this particular campus that I analyze. These things happen every day. And my being, you know, brutalized by police happens every day. It doesn't have to be that we see a snuff video of someone being killed by the police for that to you know, it shouldn't have to take that for it to register. Like, this is an everyday thing that happens, and it happens in educational spaces or you know, in or adjacent to it. That these things are happening on an everyday level, and there are ways that people are resisting on an everyday level, but then the ways that they're resisting get taken up and used in particularly racist ways as well. And so in that chapter, I talk about white supremacists on campus, and I talk about how this video was used by white supremacists online to say the university stood up for us. And so the university in doing this work of, you know, we want to champion diversity, we want to embrace difference, by bringing or by inviting or, you know, by admitting Black students into these spaces, what they're doing is sort of engaging in a kind of white supremacist action that is probably not intentional, but given the structures of the university, given the technologies of the university, given who, you know, the kinds of things that administrators say publicly, we can see when we start thinking about the entire, you know, the deep ecology of it. Where is this protest going, you know, this protest video going online after the fact that it, you know, it is a protest video and it demonstrates a kind of resistance? Who is it serving? Which, you know, ties back to, you know, literal slogans that were written on white supremacist posters at this university that said, quote unquote, "Save your people," to white students. So that chapter is making those connections and trying to think across all of these artifacts to really bring attention to, or call attention to, how diversity as a policy is working or not working. And what, when we think about diversity as a social good, both good as in, you know, a positive thing, and good as in a commodity, what comes to mind when we think about that, probably doesn't align with what is happening on the everyday level. In terms of thinking about the use of policy, the use of public sort of technologies, information technologies within those spaces, the use of a classroom, and all these other parts of that ecology.
Hmm. Yeah. In the world of white supremacy, how can you not be in white supremacy?
Right.
To summarize. in other words. That's really important. And we've taken up a lot of your time here now, but just to kind of wrap up, future projects, what are you working on at the moment or within the next couple of years?
So I have a few things that are gonna come out this year in terms of articles. One of them is looking at the way that we think about anti-racism as this kind of reparative thing, or a response to racism, and how we should sort of maybe reorient our understanding that it shouldn't have to take, you know, Black people being looted in a really public way for us to care about anti-racism. And what does it mean to do anti-racism that doesn't start with responding to whiteness or white fragility or emergency, you know, driven foci. And so that's one project that'll be out this year. I'm working on another project about something called rhetorical asphyxia, which is doing a deep dive into the uses of the phrase "I can't breathe," and the way that that notion of "I can't breathe" is something really deeply ecological. It's not simply a protest chant or thing, something that someone has literally said to the police to sort of try to save their lives, but also related to environmental factors such as, you know, potable drinking water, such as the way that lifestyle diseases are understood in Black communities, and the way that particular industries sort of pump that into those places. So it's thinking about the interconnectedness between the phrase "I can't breathe" and all of these different anti-Black, technologies. Book project that I'm working on next is a co-authored project called The Benevolent Gaslight, A Technology of Whiteness, which is with my friends Pritha Prasad at the University of Kansas. And this project is looking at the ways in which racialized gaslighting works in a kind of benevolent way as a means to make people of color question their memories and histories. And so it's looking at that in a number of ways, both in terms of things that are happening inside the academy, but also in popular culture and in politics, the way that racist acts tend to be framed as teaching moments, as a way to say, "Oh, I've learned from this and you can too by being racist, which affords a kind of particular ethos to people who have been racist. So it really looks at that across a number of different spectra. And so that's, there's an article version of that that's coming out soon. And the book version is likely to be out in the next couple of years. And then I'm working on another single authored project about memes and Black mimesis and the way in which memes circulate a kind of alternate form of Black meaning making throughout the Black diaspora. And I'm thinking about memes really broadly as sort of like cultural ideas that get passed on and mutate in particular ways. So I'm looking at how that relates to Black racial identity by particularly looking at particular memes, but also Black literature and music and the way that Black language and Black ideas circulate through memes and the idea of mimesis. So yeah, I'll stop talking. There is a few other projects, but that's to give you an idea of what I'm up to next. Yeah,
that's great. No, all of that sounds really interesting. I'll have to keep an eye out for all of it. Well, thanks so much, Louis, for talking about your book today.
Thank you.
And have a great afternoon. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for this opportunity to talk about my book. And I appreciate the really thought-provoking questions. Take good care.